Election 2011 coverage on Manx Radio, brought to you by PDMS.
Hello, I'm Roger Watterson with the last in this series of 15 programmes in which we feature the candidates standing for election in the 2011 general election. Today we turn the spotlight on Rushen, where six are seeking election to the three-seat constituency. We'll explore their politics, aims, hopes, ambitions and vision in a few moments, but first, a quick jog around the constituency with John Moss.
Roger, I'm in a part of the constituency of Rushen where I'm safe in saying there's absolutely no interest in this general election at all. There are no posters. I should be very surprised if any candidates have visited to press their case. Whoever wins will be a matter of complete indifference to the inhabitants. I speak of the Calf of Man. It's inside the boundaries of the desirable Manx constituency of Rushen, but the locals here will play little part in the next 5 years. The only seal of approval for any candidate will be large and rubbery and smell strongly of fish. Of course, I'm not really on the Calf. The budget wouldn't allow the cost of a crossing, and frankly, it's a bit choppy out there. But what will the Manx budget allow in the next term? The economy will be a major aspect of this election in this constituency, which has in the past nurtured the likes of past president and MHK Noel Kringle, and arguably the finest politician and statesman of the Manx modern era, Sir Miles Walker. Rushen envelops and embraces the villages of Port Erin and Port St Mary, which are perhaps in danger of joining together as well. Port St Erin, certainly to climb the steep road up to Craigneish and look back towards the lower plains, you're aware of how much the housing hinterland has spread. And inside those homes are people very concerned about where the island is going. Those in Port Erin will be more than a little interested in a number of developments, foremost the former marine biological station, but also the former now ruined swimming pool site. Port Erin is, with Peel, the HQ for the Bucket and Spade Brigade. Its beach is friendly, its beach is clean, the sea is cool, and there are cafes available close at hand, something missing in Douglas. Port St Mary, administratively, things have not always run smoothly for this picturesque village, with the possibility of a marina always in the air. Should there be one? If so, how big? Should it be in Port Erin? Part of the constituency shugs up against Castletown. Cramped Castletown is looking for somewhere to expand into. Rushen is, by and large, a collection of villages who tend to go their own way should there be greater efforts to cut costs by working together, as demonstrated by the two ports' refuse collections. And Rushen is not an easy constituency to canvass. There are homesteads tucked away in remote hinterlands where people play banjos and look at you suspiciously. A candidate may wear out a layer or two of leather getting round, but at the same time will have a moment to reflect on what a gorgeous neck of the woods this is. But those views to one side, and like the parish walk and the slock, any candidate, if successful, faces quite a slog over the next 5 years.
Well, that was John Moss. Our six candidates from Rushen, as they will appear on the ballot paper, are Phil Gawne. Before entering politics, he was a Manx language development officer, and since election in 2003, he's been Minister for Agriculture and now Minister for Infrastructure. Quinton Gill has been in the Navy, worked in social services, a probation officer and social worker, and he entered Tynwald in 2001, was Deputy Speaker of the Keys and Chairman of the MEA. David Jones is a Liberal Vannin candidate. Initially an engineer, he's been in paper recycling and manufactured hand-built cars, and he's been a college lecturer. John Orme was MHK from 1985 to 1991, and since 1995 he's been a barrister. And Lawrence Skelly is a businessman who runs a wholesale company and an event management company. And Ewan Watterson, he's a chartered accountant and was elected to the Keys in 2006. As in all our constituency programmes, and before we enter into discussion, the candidates are invited to talk to us for a maximum of 2 minutes on any topic of their personal choice and without interruption, other than by me if they run over the time. This we do in alphabetical order, so first we call on Phil Gawne.
Ladies and gentlemen, our island is facing one of the most difficult five-year periods in its long and independent history. The forthcoming election is therefore the most important for a generation, and I must congratulate Manx Radio for its excellent coverage and presentation of the facts to help you decide who to vote for. It has been my privilege to represent the people of Russian for the past 8.5 years, and I ask you to consider my proven track record of delivery for the people of Russian and the Isle of Man when you cast your vote. In the 6.5 years I've been minister, I have worked tirelessly to deliver better, more efficient and effective services and have significantly reduced the budgets I've been responsible for. £5 million less will be spent this year as a direct result of my actions. That said, busy people occasionally make mistakes, and I apologise for supporting my officer's design for a roundabout at Balakalawi, which costs £20,000 to £30,000 more than it needed to. In the past 5 years, I've introduced legislation for the Tynwald Auditor-General, served on select committees looking at scrutiny and the BBC licence fee, chaired the Overseas Aid Committee, developed and implemented proposals for sustainable and profitable agriculture, fisheries and forestry industries, represented the island in Brussels, London, Edinburgh, Belfast and Cardiff, introduced legislation to improve road safety and tackle dilapidated properties, reduced staff levels in DAF by 7% and DOI by 2.5%, made recommendations on how we can radically improve the management and productivity of public sector workers, and implemented measures which will save £1.5 million from our properties budget as a result of government restructuring. In Russian, I've spent £1.5 million this year improving our roads, £900,000 on Bradder, found a solution for the Marine Lab site, and worked closely with Dewan and Quinton to make more rooms available in Southlands, amongst many other things. If elected, I will get involved, not shout from the sidelines, listen to all points of view, be decisive, make sure government lives within its means, and I will continue to be open, honest, accessible and accountable. Thank you.
Right, that was from Phil Gorn. Now to Quinton Gill, please.
Goodbye, Roger. Since 2001, I have had the honour of being the full-time independent backbench member representing the people of Russian in the House of Keys and in Tynwald Court. My government roles during that decade have been in the Education Department, the Home Affairs Department, the DTI, where I had responsibility for the very successful air and shipping registries, in Dalgey, in the Tourism Department, and now currently in the Community, Culture and Leisure Department. I have been the chairman of the Office of Fair Trading, and for the past 2 years, I've been the chairman of the MEA. As an independent backbencher, I support the government when I believe they're right. I hold them to account at all times, but when they get things wrong, as unfortunately we've seen over the past few years, I very much oppose them. I hope very much that my record, rather than any rhetoric, will be the judgment that the constituents of Russian will judge my record on in the forthcoming election. Thank you.
That was Quinton Gill. The third to speak is Liberal Vanin candidate David Jones.
Good evening. I'm David Jones, seeking to represent Russian and the Liberal Vanin Party in Tynwald. I'm 58, married with two adult sons, and I'm director of two Manx companies and have worked in Australia with the Queensland State Development Board, where I advise small to medium enterprise and mentored startup businesses. I'm concerned about decisions which have created a legacy of long-term debt for future generations and set the island on a course towards insolvency. We are all aware of the weak-kneed acceptance of around £200 million in VAT reform, the MEA debacle, and the reciprocal health agreement fiasco. This speaks volumes of weak administration, and if it was private enterprise, there would have been a vote of no confidence and replacement of the board of directors long ago. With my engineering background, I have an interest in capital projects. Phase one of Aeris was underestimated by more than 60%. This is a miscalculation of gross incompetence and was eventually admitted by the chairman of the Water and Sewerage to be the omission of the residents of Malu and Russian when the population was estimated. The management structure behind capital projects is alarmingly costly, as it has been government policy to assign consultants to design and cost the projects, engage the contractors and receive a substantial percentage of the costs as their fees. Why are we employing well-paid technical experts within government and then engaging costly consultants to do their work? The IRIS scheme is hardly rocket science and could easily have been built using local contractors and labour. This would have kept public money circulating in the local economy rather than going off island to overseas consultants and contractors. Please use your vote for David Jones of the Liberal Vanin Party. I am committed to achieving the best for Russian, the island and for future generations. And a vote for any Liberal Vanin candidate is a vote for a team that can achieve change for the better. Thank you.
David Jones is followed by Dr. John Orme. I've received a lot of feedback from the public during my campaign, and a lot of it's been expressing reduced confidence and trust in government. The general view appears to be that government was out of their depth during recent years in overseas affairs, and that Tynwald has provided poor value for money because opposition has been largely ineffective and there's too much internal bickering. My observations concerning the second, the issue of Tynwald, are that far too much time is spent by MHKs sitting on endless committees, indulging in criticism rather more than making positive contributions. 24 MHKs spend too much time with everyone scrutinising everyone else, searching for weaknesses and failures in others. And thus I'm horrified by the present proposals to increase the numbers of committees. Ladies and gentlemen, generally self-scrutiny does not work. And in my submission, the basis of future scrutiny should be scrutiny by the public. And that means that the public can consider the issues that are before the government, and they may or may not increase their confidence and trust in good governance. My proposals are thus that that freedom of information measures are required soon, and that there should be fewer committees. Put simply, ladies and gentlemen, freedom of information replaces a system under which you must show why you're entitled to information with one which government must show why you are not entitled. And it means an end to the government habit of secrecy, which is, in my opinion, wasteful, counterproductive and corrosive of trust generally, if not completely delusional. In spite of repeated promises by many MHKs in government, there is still no freedom of information measure in place. Many broken promises. My promise is that if I am elected, there will be a freedom of information bill before Tynwald within 1 year. You can rely on my promise. My record is clear, because in 1991, I introduced a freedom of information bill and received no support.
Right, thank you, John. That was John Orme. And next is Lauren Skelly.
Pastor Mai, good evening, listeners, and a special warm welcome to the good people of Russian. My name is Lawrence Skelly, and as a challenger, I wish to give you some background about myself. I am 49 years of age, married for 26 years, and have two teenage children. Born and bred Manx, I have lived in America for 15 years, where I ran a successful travel business and also represented Isle of Man tourism interest in North America. I have served as president of North American Manx Association for 2 years and appointed board member of the British American Chamber of Commerce, where I've met UK and Irish ministers. Moving back to the island and living in Russian since 1999, I now run a wholesale business with my wife and have a partnership and event management company. I've been actively involved in the local community with various charities and organisations, and a member of the Port St Mary Business Association. Chairman of the Port St Mary Regeneration Committee and now member of the Southwest Regeneration Committee, I've worked tirelessly for 2 years attempting to gain central government support for our two ports. It is imperative this next government focuses on a healthy economy, for our quality of life is at stake if we don't. We need proactive politicians with strong leadership skills and proven background in delivering success. I have lived and worked through a recession, two in fact, and truly understand the value of money and offer my background of 25 years of success to help build a brighter future for us all. Thank you.
That was Lauren Skelly. Joan Watterson now, your 2 minutes please.
I'm asking for a mandate from the people of Russian on Thursday because I have a strong background, a good record in the Keys and a vision for the future of our island. I'd like to think of myself as a local lad done good, with a first-class degree in management and my time as a chartered accountant with international firm KPMG. I've chaired select committees, most recently on the high-profile collapse of Kaupthing, Singer and Friedlander. Also, as a member of the Public Accounts Committee, I've led investigations into the budget process, reserves policy and the film industry. I opposed the Chief Minister's restructure of government, which was largely a deck chair shuffling exercise on Tony Brown's Titanic. But I'm not just about numbers. In Keys, most of you will know about my private member's bill on breastfeeding, but I've also tried to pass a bill to remove secrecy from the budget process, as well as putting amendments to the social care bill, among others, to try and prevent people having to sell their homes to pay for nursing care. Looking forward, I want to see an island with a strong and diversified economy. In order to be resilient, we need to provide confidence. We need to ensure that there are no knee-jerk reactions. I also think that whilst unpalatable, a closer, not more distant relationship with the UK is what is required.
Their potential to damage us is boundless, and we can only lose. That is not to say that we sit back and get stomped on. We need to be clear in our messaging that we are not a tax haven in the Irish Sea, but an integral part of the wider British economy, and that there is mutual benefit in working together. The last government did not get this message across, which made it easier for us to be isolated and picked on. Our public finances are facing the biggest challenges for a generation, and I believe I have the right skills to redesign business processes, improve value for money, and make decisions as to areas that could be undertaken outside government. As a professional Manxman with a young daughter, no one is more aware than I am that the economy needs to succeed, public finances have to be carefully managed, and that the value for money will have to be our watchwords over the next 5 years. And I hope that you'll support my re-election.
That was Ewan Watterson. Well, there we are, six candidates, but only three seats available in Rushen. Now down to business. I've looked at all the manifestos of all you gentlemen, and there's some common ground between you all, as you might expect, especially in issues of the economy. But Phil, you say fairly early on in yours that there will be significant economic and political challenges ahead. Now, the economic ones perhaps are fairly obvious at this stage, but what are the political challenges we might face?
Well, I think the sort of political challenges clearly we're facing are how do we tackle the rebalancing of government finances. That has to be the biggest problem we're going to face. And quite clearly, what we are going to have is a more cooperative process in Tynwald. We need more team players. We need less backbiting. We need more cooperative and inclusive approach to government. I mean, if we maintain inflation at around the same level that it is at the moment over the next 5 years, even if we had a standstill budget, that's looking for a 25% reduction in the public service just to maintain a standstill budget. That's going to be very difficult to deliver, and we really do need everybody working cooperatively to actually find the solutions. One of the things I have found when I chaired the HR review, but also in the government departments as I've represented as minister, is that we have, to a certain extent, by over-scrutinising the work of government, we end up with a situation where civil servants, senior civil servants, tend to avoid making decisions. They include or they get in their experts from across the consultants and the like, because they want to avoid having to make a decision, because they know that if they get anything, even the slightest little thing wrong, so they will be hammered in Tynwald and hammered in the press.
So the political challenge is going to be not just the fact that you've got to get things organised, but there's a political challenge there in retaking a grip of your administration.
Well, I think it's that, but it's also politicians are going to have to accept that if we're going to make any progress at all, we have to allow our civil service to get on with fulfilling our wishes. We make the policy absolutely clear. Civil servants then have to try and fulfil that policy, and they have to be allowed occasionally just to take a few considered risks along the way if we're going to actually make any significant progress.
I can see the economic challenge there, but I the political challenge, where you talk about backbiting and problems in the House, if you try and remove all of that, or at least all of some of it, you won't have any form of challenge or scrutiny, will you? I mean, there's another danger hidden behind that.
I don't believe so. I think, and I would take issue with what John said earlier in his opening remarks here, what we've introduced by way of our scrutiny committees is a reduced requirement for committees rather than more committees. We've reduced the actual number of standing committees. We've reduced the need for select committees, and hopefully we can have, as I say, a collaborative working process. I mean, good example of this, as Agriculture and Fisheries Minister, I felt that I was pretty much on my own. I could pretty much do whatever I wanted, because there was very few, if any, people in Tynwald who were that bothered about agriculture and fisheries policies. What we need is a comprehensive system whereby Tynwald is working with departments to try and look for the most appropriate and best solutions.
Right. Now, John Orme, you touched on this subject, but in a slightly different way, because you went a little deeper in one sense. You said, unless the next Tynwald takes the tough decisions necessary, which we can understand that, but to secure our financial independence, not just balance the books, financial independence, we risk losing our political independence too. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think the main political objective should be to try and address this question are we satisfied that we should continue with an arrangement under which the United Kingdom government effectively controls a large chunk, the VAT income, of our government? And if the answer to that is no, we are not satisfied, it's in the interest of the Isle of Man to continue with that arrangement, we need to consider alternatives. And we need to do that early. We need to be prepared, because I'm convinced that the United Kingdom government will come back and further squeeze us. I do not believe that they will leave us alone.
So, to quote again your manifesto, so looking at the future intentions of the United Kingdom in relation to the Isle of Man, it must be concluded, you say, that it's more likely that they will not be entirely into our benefit. They will not be in the Isle of Man's interest. Well, now, are you saying that you just think it might happen, or you're fairly certain it will?
I'm fairly certain it will. My view is that the United Kingdom government has changed character through necessity. It is now a government in desperate financial circumstances, and it also is governing via a coalition, one part of which the Lib Dems really don't like us at all. So they have the government in the United Kingdom has a political imperative and a financial incentive to squeeze us further. And desperate people and desperate governments behave in a quite different way from the normal behaviour they might otherwise have demonstrated.
Ewan Watterson, only in the news today, the UK David Cameron said that the world is staring down the barrel of a new economic catastrophe. Now, we can't be isolated, can we? If that is the case, we can't be isolated from it. I mean, would you agree with John that we're heading for another scrap and perhaps we should be better fitted for it this time?
Well, I don't know what's in the recesses of the mind of the British government. I would certainly say that, yes, the world is facing challenging economic times, and we are going to have to work twice as hard to make sure that our economy continues to grow when all about us are suffering from real problems. Where I think I probably differ is that I think we need to be working far closer with the UK government rather than getting further away from them. And that's why I've undertaken things such as the Armed Forces Parliamentary Scheme. There's no better opportunity to spend a long-haul flight next to a government minister or opposition MP and to start building these relationships so that we can actually get the message across that the Isle of Man is an integral part, not just of the British economy, but Britain generally in terms of the armed forces as well. So there are a lot of good messages for the Isle of Man out there. It's our responsibility and it's the next government's responsibility to make sure that that gets across to MPs, because the last government didn't do that very well.
But if you look back at previous governments, previous chief ministers have said that they did have this relationship. In fact, the Blair government did understand the value of the Isle of Man to the British economy. So what's gone wrong?
Well, I think there's been a lack of engagement in the last 5 years, and I don't know whether that's because of an increased desire for independence or whether it was out of other factors and other distractions. But certainly it hasn't been a relationship that's been keenly worked on by the council ministers in the last 5 years. Now, I know that they have started going to party conferences, and that's a step in the right direction. We need to be far more in the face of London. I think the Falkland Islands provides an excellent opportunity and a great model for how you can engage politically down in Westminster.
I'd have to disagree, though, with Ewan on that in relation to engagement with UK and indeed other parliamentarians. It is certainly not the case that government hasn't been engaged in that. We've probably done more in the last 5 years than we've done at any other time. We've had agreed with the UK our international personality agreement, which finally allows us to go out into the big wide world and represent ourselves on an awful lot more issues that the UK formerly used to represent us on.
We still need their approval to the results, though, don't we?
Not entirely. I mean, we can actually go out there now and negotiate and talk to people. I mean, and again, you know, I've spent an awful lot of my time as DAF minister going around just making deals, discussing the way forward with my colleagues, ministers in particularly the fisheries ministers in the different devolved assemblies and parliaments, but also the Secretary of State in the UK. You know, it's just not correct to suggest that we haven't been engaging. I think John hit it on the head, and that's when he's saying that the UK are in desperate financial position. That's why we're getting this negativity coming towards
us. The problem, isn't it, with the government at the moment, here we are going into an election now, and obviously many election candidates in all constituencies trade on the negative because because they're trying to show how, in fact, they will be much better than those who've gone before them. But, Quentin, you came up with a point which is related to this, because the public really have sometimes difficulty making objective and informed decisions because the information isn't there for them to make it on. VAT was a good example of that. You say the culture of secrecy, which has sadly characterised this government, is regrettable. Now, you're the only person that's actually referred to a culture of secrecy.
Well, I'd stand by that. It is regrettable. It's very unfortunate. And frankly, if it's the characteristic of the next government, when we, as Phil has quite rightly, belatedly but rightly identified, that culture has to change. I do take issue. I mean, you asked the fundamental question at the outset, and I think we should all be crystal clear. Because there are fault lines between us, as I see them, how far down the independence line and independence debate do candidates think we should go?
Are we talking about
my own view in terms of policy, rather than the some of the rhetoric that we've heard, is that, and I agree with Juan here, that our most important relationship is with the United Kingdom. It has gone sour. That needs to be addressed very firmly. Juan touched on the Falkland Islands government model, which I have introduced Tony Brown to, and fair play, he did make time to go and visit the Falkland government office. It's a model that they offered up to us as a hit-the-ground-running model, and it's very unfortunate that wasn't taken further. Be that as it may, in the future we have to up our game. But why bother upping your game relating better to Britain if the intention is to move away from Britain? I think that's an extremely dangerous concept. And my own view is that our relationship with Britain is the first focus that we need to build on in our external
relations. Are we not actually being forced away, though?
I don't believe we are. I'm not sure why it would be in British interest to cripple the Isle of Man. If they wanted to do that, they could have very, very easily done it already.
Money.
Yes, the VAT deal has been to our disadvantage. But when we've heard other members of council ministers saying we were getting money from the previous deals that we weren't entitled to, I'm hardly surprised that we're faced with this deal.
I think it's fair to say, Roger, though, that the relationship has been ineffective of recent, and I don't think anyone could disagree with that. And what we need is obviously an effective relationship there, without doubt, but we do need to examine all the options. But you have to look back. You know, one of the things that struck me, and you mentioned the Falkland Islands there, you know, they have their own body, their own people on the ground in London. And, you know, what we have done in the last administration, we spent, I think, £450,000 on a very prestigious office in central London, whereas we could have actually spent that money on a lobby group or having our own people. So we do need to spend money wisely, and we do need to find lobby interest in London, without doubt, because they are our greatest trading partner, but politically, we're at loggerheads.
You talk about a lobbying interest, but there is an argument, and I've heard it many times in this election, that if we adopt lobbying companies and do it by that particular channel, we're actually downgrading the Isle of Man's relationship with the UK administration. We have rights of contact already. Why need a lobbyist?
Well, we do, but, you know, what happened to them? I've heard of an Anglo-Manx political alliance that used to be around for 10 years ago.
Still
is. It's no longer there. Well, Andrew McKinley, I believe, is the man that they use, but that has somewhat diminished and eroded. And it comes down to how effective these relationships are. And as it has been shown, you know, we only just got a look, you just mentioned the VAT, you can look at the health deal, the Icelandic bank issue, and of course the 010 that's upon us. So we do need an effective relationship, and we do need to examine all the options.
I'll have to come in and correct Lawrence's misunderstanding about the Anglo-Manx parliamentary group. The Chief Minister was actually down last week meeting them. It was the most highly attended meeting that we've had for many, many years with them. So it's certainly not correct to say that that group doesn't exist. It's also...
It's
also not correct to suggest that we are not meeting with these people on a regular basis. But as John has rightly said at an earlier stage, the United Kingdom government is in deep financial trouble. Mm-hmm. That's why they're after us. No matter how popular we are, no matter how we've built relationships, they're after us.
All of you talking about what you should and shouldn't do, but David Jones, you went a stage further. You said that, in fact, if we don't get it right, we're heading for insolvency. Now, that is a very down-market statement, isn't it, when you think that there's a growth in the economy and a vast number of Isle of Man systems are running as well, if not better, than their United Kingdom counterparts. So are you not talking down our economy a little bit too much at a time when perhaps we should be talking it up?
I think, Roger, we're in a very unstable situation at the moment. We have great debts that are unserviceable.
Such as?
The MEA loss of around $400 million. The outlay on the hospital. The numerous capital projects that have been expended with a theory of we can just service the interest payments and as time passes, inflation will take care of the debt and diminish it.
We've got the chap sitting next to you who must have your eye on the MEA figures. This business of only servicing the interest, there's no sinking fund, is there? That's the point that David's making.
Well, David makes a point which is valid to a certain degree, that the MEA have, I have inherited a huge debt at the MEA, there's no secrecy about that. That will primarily have to be paid in two tranches through bond repayments in the near future. Treasury are aware of that. This is a government debt, not an MEA debt. I very much regret
it. It's all public money, though.
It is all public money, and that is the point. The MEA is part of government. That has been my mantra as chairman. The debt is a public debt. Was the money well spent? I believe it was. Should it have been spent should it have been borrowed in the manner it was? No, I certainly don't believe that's the case. But we are where we are. I do think that instead of simply saying that's the problem with the MEA, there really is a responsibility on David and Liberal Vannon, if they are to have a coherent policy, to actually explain what they would do about it. All I've heard is that they would close the power stations. Now, that doesn't make any kind of sense to me.
I don't recall ever saying close the power stations.
I seem to recall reading that in your letter that you sent to the people of Russian, but you could explain what you're... And rather than me put words in your mouth, you could tell us how the MEA should progress.
Well, the problem with the power stations is they were an indulgence. We didn't actually need so many power stations and a link to the UK national grid. The result is that the power station at Peel only operates for 2 hours a day.
But I think the point that we're getting to, David, that's it, if I may say so, that's maybe indeed details and part of the past history, but you've identified a problem and we're going into a new parliament now.
Exactly.
So what are we going to do about those problems, or what would you do about
them? We're going in with a large level of debt, which is not a comfortable situation given the global economic climate at the moment.
So what do we do about it?
Well, the present minister's theory is that we have a capital reserve fund that we can dip into. And yes, we do have a capital reserve, but you can only dip into it so many times before it's gone. And once it's gone, we're going to be in the similar situation as many of the EU member countries now that are begging for assistance. And I don't want to see that happen.
Well, you, Lawrence Skelly, did actually refer to something similar. You said you want to reduce our dependency on imported energy, currently at 95%. How would you intend to do that? Because we've just heard here now we've got the power station, likely to have it for quite a few years yet.
We do. What we need is a long-term strategy to reduce that and obviously work towards a more sustainable position. What I've stated in my manifesto is that is the creation of an energy and natural resources division that we could actually make a bigger priority with regards to setting some policy and working in some strategy.
Right, well, I'd like to explore that a bit further, but it's time now to take a commercial break, and it just takes 2 minutes for one of these breaks, so don't go away. We'll be back after this.
Election 2011 coverage on Manx Radio, brought to you by PDMS.
In this, the final edition of Manx Radio's series of constituency specials, our candidates are from Russian. They are Duard Watterson, Lawrence Skelly, John Orme, David Jones, Quinton Gill and Phil Gorme. Now, Gorme, I should say, not Gorme, Gorme. I was looking at John Orme here. John, I'm looking through your documentation. There's two things which caught my eye. One was I said about the financial and political independence, but the other one, you say in one paragraph that you would not support policies which erode the individuality of the Isle of Man and don't want to see the Isle of Man become a replica of the UK or where else. On another paragraph, very close, you say, harping on about our unique Manxness will not help us. So, I mean, those two are to a certain degree contradictory, aren't they?
One refers to the economic situation. If you look, the harping on about our unique Manxness refers to the economic situation. The other refers to the fact that I like the quirky individuality of the Isle of Man. It's something that attracts me here and keeps me here. So, no, they're not contradictory. Can I return, Roger, if you don't mind, to a matter which I think we need to discuss more? It is the issue of our relationship with the United Kingdom. It's been characterised as moving closer or moving further away, and I don't think those are really the options. It's a question of who is going to define the terms of the next engagement, in my view. And is there not an argument that we might have brought some of this upon ourselves? Is there not an argument that we've perhaps been a little too boastful in the past, and rather like the man who boasts about his salary and boasts about his new car, he doesn't get a very positive reaction? My instincts, and I'm interested to see whether anyone else agrees with this, my instincts are the opposite. My instincts are that we should quietly get on with our business, but be prepared to defend ourselves vigorously if necessary, and be ready to do so. And I rather think, to try and put some historical perspective on it, isn't it correct that once we relied upon Manannan's cloak to defend us from the Celtic raiders by making us nearly invisible? And I prefer to keep a low profile and get on with our business.
I think John is probably right there in that that's what we always used to do.
Yes.
Unfortunately, though, the United Kingdom particularly keeps sending envoys over to the Isle of Man to scrutinise us quite intensely to find out what we're doing and what we're up to. And sadly, the world in which we now inhabit is all about us defending ourselves on an international stage. But I do agree that if we possibly can, we should try and possibly be a little less visible with the United Kingdom. But I also believe we should be strengthening our links with other countries, with other international bodies, so that we have other friends and we're not wholly reliant on the United Kingdom in the future.
There were huge constitutional developments from the 1970s right the way through, and they didn't happen by accident. They happened with a great deal of face-to-face negotiation and planning. Now, I think the question that John is perhaps raising, there is always been a fear that if we're seen to be too successful, the UK won't like it. That was written in the Kilbrandon report back in the 1970s. But surely a certain amount of business confidence has to be necessary to expand the economy. And secondly, I would still query what has happened with the relationships and negotiating facilities that existed in the past and don't seem to exist today.
Well, I would disagree that they don't exist today. What we have had in the last few years particularly is the United Kingdom government, which is desperate. And we mustn't forget that. They have a serious financial problem. We obviously are facing difficult and uncertain political times, financial times in the next 5 years. But let's not forget, we've got 18 months' worth of expenditure in reserves. You know, we've done all the clichés. We've mended the roof while the sun was shining. We've put money aside for the rainy day. We've done all this, unlike the United Kingdom government and unlike many governments, I have to say, in the Western world.
Quinton?
Well, I have to say, the first I've heard about series of UK envoys coming to the Isle of Man to scrutinise the Isle of Man government is what I've heard this evening.
What review? Edwards
Would you
review,
remember the Edwards report?
Do you not remember
I do recall those, but I don't recall the ongoing series over the last 18 months as we've just had described. And anyway,
I don't know who described that.
My point is that John's issue about the last about the boastfulness, or certainly the lack of seeming to reflect the fact that we are in straitened times, certainly over the last two budgets, I think I would suggest, have not been helpful towards the impression that we have clearly garnered with the UK. And that's unfortunate. But it does all come back to, and I think John makes a valid point, how we behave is how we will be received. And that has to change.
A little bit of forelock touching doesn't help either, though.
No,
it doesn't. And who's suggesting that we do that? All I'm suggesting is that we build a positive, trusting, open relationship back up with the United Kingdom. It quite clearly can happen. Phil is quite right. The United Kingdom have got huge challenges, and that they are doing exactly what they're doing to the Isle of Man, to their own councils across the British Isles. And we have to... We're not going to be separate from that. But that doesn't mean the fact that we cannot still represent our story much better. And in doing that, hopefully we will be able to represent our best interests better.
David?
I do agree with John that the UK is in a desperate financial situation and more than likely to come back and try and have another grab at our assets. And we really need to structure our economy to be in a position of readiness to be able to say no. And as much as I wish to retain the ties that we've got with the UK, we cannot afford to have someone who's going to steal all our assets. Otherwise, we'll be at the mercy of everyone.
I think when we're sort of talking about how well we've done over the last few years and start sort of bragging about how much we've got in the bank, we've got to get our figures right. I mean, 18 months spending in reserves, well, yeah, that's fine, but that's the pension fund and a lot of other things with it. So that there is, in fact, about sort of 3 months' worth of spending in a sort of in a pot that we could actually use that's not tied down.
£427 million is more than 3 months' expenditure.
It's about, it's about £427 million at half, but it depends on how you break down the general reserve. But then the other thing about this stance of keep your head down because the UK financial situation, and I do understand the psychology of that, but the trouble is that when we're going out and selling the Isle of Man to the world, the last thing you want to hear is who are you then? Even down in London, you get who are you? So in a moment, you go out to China, go out to India, go out to the Middle East and start trying to promote the Isle of Man. So I don't think that keeping the head down is a realistic option. I think it's about better informing the UK, because when people are looking internationally about placing business, you can go offshore USA, you can go offshore, you know, Netherlands Antilles, or you can go offshore Britain. And there's a role for the Isle of Man in being part of the business mix for any multinational corporation that comes to the UK. We put a lot of money through the City of London. It's a key economic relationship, and it's far more important that the UK sees and understands the benefit of it than keeping our head down.
So the argument really is not so much where the problems are now, but keeping the advantages we've got. This is the point that John's getting here, so that not, somebody doesn't decide that, oh, there's a few more bob there, we'll have it.
Oh, absolutely. So they've got to understand that we're able to provide this element of the wider sort of British economy under these sort of circumstances. We shouldn't be sort of lying down and just sort of taking it from Britain. They've got to understand that this is our, you know, this is how we are helping them, and there's a value on that.
I think the question is what are we going to do and what are we planning to do? We've had the two VAT grabs, as we know about, and this new tax-based measurement method is quite clearly open to interpretation, and therefore they can come back. So the question has it been effective in the past? No. What are we doing now in the future? And that's what I think we need to do as a matter of urgency. We need to examine what our options are so as we can be prepared. There is the issue. That's the political process. We cannot lose sight, obviously, that the UK is our biggest trading partner. And we do feed London with massive amount of money. We've been trying to get that message over for a very long time, but again, it's not very effective. And it probably, as I said, comes back to pointing to what was said earlier about having our own people in London lobbying our interests, both in terms of our business and our political interests. It's not just London. I think also with regards to Brussels and further afield into London. Christine Lagarde was here a couple of years ago, said favourable things about the Isle of Man. What is she now? She's now president of the IMF. And that we should be nurturing that relationship for the betterment of the Isle of Man.
And indeed we are nurturing those sorts of relationships. But I have to explode this myth that in some way negotiations in the past haven't been good on the likes of the VAT.
They've been secret.
Two years ago, we were getting twice as much per head as UK citizens were getting. At the moment, we're getting between 10 and 15% per head more.
Does that mean they're going to come back for another 10 or 15%?
No, it doesn't mean that at all, because the UK average is not the same as as the Isle of Man. The Isle of Man's economy is stronger than the United Kingdom, there's no doubt about that. Our spending power in the Isle of Man is considerably higher than the United Kingdom average. You know, we should be comparing ourselves in terms of our spending power with counties in the southeast of England. So the 10 to 15% is a reasonable deal. That's a good deal, in fact, for the Isle of Man. And, whilst we've been getting the extra money, which the United Kingdom has signed up to, we've got what we deserved. While we've been getting that extra money, we have, as I say, mended the roof while the sun was shining, and we've put a lot of money into reserves. That's a good and positive thing.
One of the problems, of course, is, as I said before, a lot of this is a matter of perception. And as far as the public is concerned, they see a reciprocal health agreement that nearly went belly up until other people took control and did something about it. And they perhaps see, rightly or wrongly, what you say, but there's no absolute information. The information is very scanty sometimes, and it's almost like, trust me, I'm a doctor. Now, Juan, you actually said, and you've been on about this for a long time, that you think there should be a lot more transparency at the budgetary stage in the government budget. Now, was that transparency for the public to understand the figures, or for the members of the House just to understand it?
Well, they work off each other, don't they? By the public understanding, I think members will get a better understanding. Most members don't have a financial background, are given 6 days in secret to look at the budget, to understand it and work out which way they're going to vote. It's announced by the Treasury Minister in the morning, it's voted on in the afternoon, public input's absolutely nothing. And I think it's about time that that changed.
Now, there was an argument at the last, not so much an argument as a little bit of a discomfort at the last budget, that how good the budget was, it still had this element of smoke and mirrors in it, because it couldn't work out what went when and how did it. Would your plan solve that?
I think it would. I think it would open up scrutiny of the budget to a far broader audience, and one that's far more technically capable than members of Tynwald. It gives people the opportunity to lobby. I think the bill had a number of things to recommend it, not least for the ability to put cost neutral amendments as determined by Treasury. So I think that I don't see what the Treasury is scared of, apart from the fact that maybe they didn't know the budget as well as they thought they did and don't like it being challenged by others.
Is it time, perhaps, then, for government to look at the way that it keeps its books, at the way it looks after them, the way it actually accounts? Because we have got public service account at the moment, which is generally a form of cash book accounting. It's not a commercial form, is it?
No, I think on the whole, the island's Treasury does have a commitment to move towards financial reporting standards. It's done well on that. It hasn't moved as fast as I'd like, but I think it's made all the right moves, and I wouldn't criticise it for that. As I say, we're doing group accounts, we're doing international standards, and I think that's the way we should be doing it.
Yes, I just see that we have people saying we've cut the departmental budget, for instance, Quintin, and then you find that actually a substantial part of that cut is the fact that Treasury have just removed the loan charges.
Well, absolutely. I think you used the phrase smoke and mirrors, and I think that many people listening to this would sound a very clear resonance. Clarity. It is a complex process. It's a complex issue, but surely the challenge is to demystify and to publicise the process as best we can. I don't see any appetite for that from government, and I hope that will change, because trust is an absolutely crucial element in any relationship, and in a small community, the relationship of trust between any government and the people who are governed is fundamental. And it's unfortunate that we're at the pitch that we're at. There is no point going on about that, but there is a point in learning from that.
What you're saying with regards to trust and smoke and mirrors, and going back to what John said about the Freedom of Information Act, this is something I've heard, you know, quite frequently on the doorstep. It hasn't come through. I mean, you know, what is the reason? Can you perhaps give us?
I think there is a very simple reason on that, and the officer who was dealing with this fell ill at a fairly crucial stage in the development.
Yes,
of the
but that can't be good enough. There's 24 MHKs. Anyone could have picked up the bill. Anyone could have got on with it.
I think it is.
And there was
enough,
a promise made.
And if somebody's not capable of completing their duties, that was the reason why.
We plagiarise a bill from somewhere else. We don't need to write one ourselves.
One at a time, gentlemen.
The bill has had its first reading, and the bill is ready to go at the first sitting.
It's failed to come through.
The bill is ready to go.
Ministers have said in here that it's been a cost factor. That has been a reason. That I've heard to at least two ministers mention on this programme. And the question I have is, if it is a cost factor, how can we justify it? Now, we just heard a little bit about that today. You know, one of the issues, how much does it cost to ask a question? During you
90 quid, apparently, according to the official
quid.
Answer.
You did 270, I think. Yep. You know, your man Karen does more than that. Isn't there a cost involved with that? Wouldn't that possibly justify this Freedom of Information Act?
There will be costs with Freedom of Information. Of course there will.
But we could justify it here.
Well, there will be savings in that we will not have to have some of these massively expensive public inquiries which squander money, spend years coming to a conclusion and only make any kind of decision when everyone's forgotten or has lost interest in the matter.
freedom of information would actually save money overall, even with, I believe, the costs of introducing it and administering it and policing it.
Because I would agree with you, yeah, definitely.
And I would agree too, and I've been pushing for this both before I was in Council of Ministers and inside Council of Ministers, along with a number of my colleagues. We have been trying to progress this, and I do think that the reason I'm coming forward is not just an excuse.
Roger, can I go back to something? Because I just want to see what everyone thinks of this. Is it possible that our message is so good that we're missing the obvious, that a government which has a surplus in its current account, has no borrowings and has reserves, is so extraordinary, so unusual in the modern Western world, that we really do not need to go out there and shout about it too much? The very fact that it exists is enough. And if we can hold on to that fiscal prudence, we will prosper.
Now, I would like to explore that a lot further, but we're getting very close in time for the end of the programme, gentlemen. So I would like to ask you all the very obvious question and go round the table quickly, maybe, with this just a couple of sentences each. Why, gentlemen, should the voters in Russian vote for you? Jewin Mortensen.
Well, I'd like to think that after 5 years, I've got a good track record. My experience sets me in good stead. I've been dealing with the problems. I stand as a critic of the excesses of government, part of the solution as a member of the Department of Economic Development. I'm an independent thinker, I'm an independent candidate, and I hope people will vote for that on Thursday.
Lawrence Kelly.
Tonight, you've heard from your candidates in Russian. And next Thursday, you will have an opportunity to exercise your right to vote and place that trust for your future. I pledge to you, the good people of Russian, I will be open, I will be honest, and most importantly, I will stand up for you and all the people of the Isle of Man.
Right, now, John, please.
Because I will be a positive force in Tynwald, and I will seek at all times to strengthen good governance in the Isle of Man.
David Jones.
We cannot afford to return the same government to power. We need a fresh team of ministers with strong policies who will not just be yes men or women to the Chief Minister. The election is not a popularity contest, but a selection of people for their skills in providing a secure and better future for the island.
Quinton Gill.
I think my record proves I'm an independent MHK who stands up to be counted on matters of important principle. They are the guiding principles that have been mine over the last decade, and I will continue to be guided by them.
And Phil Gorm.
I've got a proven track record in tackling difficult issues and delivering change. I'm a team player. I like to get involved to make things happen. I will make sure that government lives within its means and continue to be open, honest, accessible and accountable if elected.
And there we must end this election special featuring the candidates for the Russian constituency. There were Phil Gorm, Quinton Gill, David Jones, John Ohm, Lawrence Skelly and Jewin Watterson. We're not only at the end of this edition, but also at the end of the series of programmes in which Beth and I met all 64 candidates. And we'll be back again with the team of reporters on Thursday for election night with full and live coverage of the exit polls and results. If you'd like to hear again all or part of any of these special programmes, all 15 are available on Manx Radio's special election website. The constituency profiles were by Dan Walker and John Moss. The studio production was by Mark Tarley and Alex Brindley, and the producer was Catherine Nicol. Beth Espy was my colleague. I'm Roger Watterson. Goodbye.